Hi, I'm Sharon Lunt.
I'm Karen Vandenberg, and we're from the Manx Endometriosis Support Group.
It is very complicated, isn't it? But for those who aren't aware and don't have to deal with it, I mean, how could you sum it up as a condition? What is it like to have endometriosis, as complex as it is? How can you sort of sum it up for us?
I would say it's different for everybody. You can't say it's the same for every person who's impacted by it. Like we were saying, it's a multi-systemic disease. Some people get horrendous pain. Some people never get any pain. Mm-hmm. Some people's symptoms are like fatigue, IBS type symptoms. Some people don't find out until they can't get pregnant. Some people don't find out until they're in menopause or they've lost a kidney. So it's really difficult. But I suppose if you're the person, if you have period pain, you have clots, you have heavy bleeding, you have
the fatigue. The fatigue seems to be the most common that I've seen amongst people. I know somebody that's had endometriosis. They had no pain whatsoever. They didn't really have any symptoms. They found out when they went for tests about why they couldn't get pregnant. And when they had an investigative laparoscopy, that's when they found out that they actually had endometriosis all the way up onto their lungs. Mm-hmm. So it's difficult. It's hard for us to sort of, even living with the disease, to sort of pinpoint how to describe how most people feel. So obviously, at the same time, while we do say more needs to be done, it must be hard for medical professionals to also...
Well, that's maybe why it's often misdiagnosed, isn't it?
So that's why we need the pathways. Mm-hmm. And I think it needs to go back to education from school age girls right through to medical professionals so that it becomes recognised that actually it is a problem. And actually, it doesn't matter if you send that person through and the diagnosis isn't endometriosis. Isn't it better if it isn't? Or maybe it's something else. Because it's not going to be nothing if you're presenting with those symptoms. The sooner you get that person assessed and diagnosed, easier they can access, the quicker they can access the care that they need. Mm-hmm. And then you're empowering them to know, actually, okay, I've got endometriosis, or I haven't, and I've got this condition. But what we do know is that people do get misdiagnosed a lot, and this is the most underdiagnosed disease that there is at the minute. It's like 1 in 7 women. But that's only the ones who've had a diagnosis. There's so many people out there who are undiagnosed. So I think if you're having period pain, like I said, if you've got clots, heavy bleeding throughout the month, not normal, intermittent bleeding, pain
during sex, pain when you go to the toilet, pain when you need the toilet, pain after you've been to the toilet. Mm. I read a blog and the woman, she used a few curse words, said that when I go to the toilet, I'm sweating, I'm in agony, I'm trying not to go, but at the same time, I'm trying to go because I know once I've actually been, I will come downstairs back to work like nothing's happened. But it is the worst 10 minutes of my life going to the toilet. I mean, obviously, she went into a bit more detail and there was a few more choice words in there than what I've used. But she did sort of encompass how I felt going to the toilet. Mm. I mean, that's not normal.
No, it's really not.
And in schools, I know that my daughter was told during a PSHE lesson, periods are painful. They're not. Periods are mildly discomfort. They should never prevent you from doing anything. They should never leave you curled up with a hot water bottle on the paracetamol. I mean, even if you think back to pain medication that was done in a pink box and it was designed all around period pain. I can't remember what it was. It was sort of from the early 2000s, late 90s. But there was an actual brand of ibuprofen that was marketed for
that,
girls. Yeah. I can't remember what they're called now. But they were marketed for girls who had period pain. I mean, they actually designed a whole medication around these painful periods. Now, yes, they are needed when you've got endometriosis, but it is marketed that that's normal.
Yeah.
That you go out to the chemist and you buy these medications. They help with your periods and then you go back off as normal. You've got 2 weeks. I found ovulation pain was excruciating. My ovulation pain was far worse than my period pain, which I'm grateful for. So ovulation is sort of a 24-hour thing. I had the run-up. Obviously, I could tell you which side I ovulated from because it was that painful.
Wow.
And I could tell you where it was in my body because it was so unbelievably painful. Some women suffer with their periods and they can start 2 or 3 days before their period. Then obviously you've got 4 days of your period, and then normally it sort of tapers off 2 or 3 days after it. That's a week.
So we started the group in February 2023. I was recovering from surgery and thought maybe this was something that we needed to do. Sharon was also in the same position and she agreed. So we decided to set up the Facebook group because we both knew how difficult it had been for us to access the care that we needed.
The purpose is to get better care and first-time diagnosis for people. So it's rather than having four surgeries like myself, they just have the one surgery, and it is the right type of surgery that should see them with better recovery over the longer periods.
It is about having a community network. So obviously the Facebook group, people can come there and ask questions. We obviously post, we try to post information that's educational, and we do link people in with other groups from our group. So there's a Facebook page called Nancy's Nook Endometriosis Education page. Nancy is a retired gynecology nurse. She lives in America. And she used to work with Dr. Redvine, who was the pioneer in the gold standard of surgery for endometriosis. So her page is has a wealth of information on it, and it helps the person navigate and helps them advocate for their own health, because there's doctors on there called Nook doctors who are basically, I suppose, the best in the game. And there's UK-based ones, they're all over the world because people do travel for their surgery. People from Ireland, specifically, they always go to the UK because there's no specialists in Ireland. Obviously, on the island, we do travel to the UK if we need private care for the surgery. But some people do go as far as Europe.
So there's myself and Karen, and I've had endometriosis myself for 16 years. Karen has had it for many years, but hers is a bit more complicated than my story.
Yeah. I didn't know I had endometriosis. I can now reflect and know I did from a teenager, because my main symptoms were at puberty onset of fatigue that would fluctuate. And I never really knew why, and different types of sort of IBS type symptoms. I did have period pain, but it wasn't horrendous. It wasn't until 2016, after my son was born, that the symptoms got significantly worse, and I was 5 years backwards and forwards before there was any recognition of what it might be. And that's when I started to educate myself and then advocate for what I needed.
My story was very different. I was diagnosed many years ago, and I was asked if I was prepared to drive to Ramsey. If I was to drive to Ramsey Cottage Hospital, my wait time to see the gynaecologist was only 3 weeks, as he'd just arrived on the island. So while the majority of cases are 9 years from sort of going to the GP about their symptoms to diagnosis, it's approximately 9 years for most women. I was very lucky that I was diagnosed verbally within about 3 months, and then confirmed via surgery and treated within 12 months. So that's a really successful story. And then I had my daughter, who's now going to be 15 next week, and we had my son in between that. It looks like my symptoms come back, but because I then had another child, it sort of tapered off. And then after having him, it just skyrocketed. So it does come back without the right surgery. So obviously it shows that over here they do ablation surgery, which is the burning of the endometriosis from the tissues. Whereas in the UK, I was under Manchester St Mary's, I had excision surgery. So that's where they actually dig out the root of the endometriosis and take it all away. So if any disease is missed while you are still ovulating, it does always have the risk of it being able to come back.
It can be microscopic as well. So if you're younger and you present with a disease and you do get surgery, which is unusual, and you still have the specialist surgery then, because it's microscopic, it could still be missed and it can still grow and you probably need more surgery. But you still need that surgery. But obviously, at the age I was, which was 40, I think, 41 when I had the surgery, my endometriosis lesions would have been, well, they were quite advanced. So, and I was with a specialist, and he was able to remove everything. I didn't have a hysterectomy. The myth is that you need a hysterectomy. Now, in some cases, yes, you do. But I think what we need to raise awareness of is you don't. If you have the right surgery, you don't need a hysterectomy. You just need removal of the endometriosis. And because endometriosis, you have to be trained to recognise what it looks like, and it comes in different colours. That's something that, like, if you're not a specialist surgeon, you're not going to know. And also, when people have been taking hormone-suppressing medications and they go for surgery, unless you're with a specialist and they do surgery, they're going to miss potentially lesions that are there because the hormone-suppressing medication has reduced some of the inflammation. It's really, really important that we get basically people to the right surgeon at the right time.
The thing that I read in previous case histories, and this is not just relevant to the Isle of Man. I spoke to a GP about my endometriosis, and he was from the UK. He was over helping during the winter. And I said about, I had breathing pains with my endometriosis, which they thought was possibly thoracic, which means it can be on your lungs. And he was like, it's a gynecological issue. And I was like, no, it's not. I was like, you can get it on your lungs. And he actually Googled it while he was with me in the surgery. And he was like, every day is a school day. Mm-hmm. So some surgeons, when they actually do it, and again, I'm not sort of branding the Isle of Man here, this has also come from information in the UK, is they only look around your reproductive organs. They would never look up towards your lungs. They would never look towards the sort of abdomen wall. Yeah. I had it on my spinal tendons. I had it on my hip joint. I had it on my bowel. It was connecting my small bowel to my large bowel. I had it on my kidneys, and it was connecting my tailbone tendons to my back, basically. Mm-hmm. And I have ongoing pain with that because obviously at the moment my nerves are very inflamed. It's only just a year since my surgery, so they're still quite inflamed and still quite sore. So even after the surgery, a year on.
Recovery isn't quick from the surgery, and that's what needs to be appreciated as well, because I would say you're 18 months to 2 years recovering from the scar tissue. But that's the surgery. That's what you can see. In addition to that, you've got to look at the whole picture of the person that's in front of you. And I think that's one of the other places after surgery that needs to be focused on and where it falls short of care. Because, yes, you need the surgery, absolutely, 100%. But whilst you're waiting for the surgery even, and after the surgery, you need long-term support and follow-up. And I'm not saying services can keep people open forever in a day, because they can't, but it's a multi-system inflammatory condition. So like Sharon was saying, she had thoracic. Thoracic is the most common place for endometriosis to grow after the pelvic area. But then, you know, you can have it. It's very rare, but some people have had it found in their brains, in their eyes. Yeah. So we don't understand enough about the condition. But what we do know is people that have endometriosis are more likely to have comorbidities. So we're talking about autoimmunity, celiac disease.
I've got celiac disease. Yeah. They are actively looking for a link between the two.
Yeah.
For that at the moment.
There's other conditions that people aren't so aware of. Like some people, unless they've got the diagnosis, wouldn't even know what it is. Ehlers-Danlos. So it's a connective tissue disorder, and that's also on a spectrum. And the research is showing now. And what's very interesting is people in the group will say, oh, actually, I'm hypermobile. It doesn't mean they've got an Ehlers-Danlos diagnosis, But there's more research going into that condition as well, whilst also endometriosis. But there's a significant link in women with endometriosis and connective tissue disorders. So that's something that obviously has an impact on a person's health. And people with that condition have a higher risk of also autoimmune conditions. And linked with that also is a histamine intolerance that a lot of women report, because endometriosis is an estrogen dominant condition. Estrogen upregulates histamine. So when our progesterone is out of balance and our histamine is higher because the estrogen is driving that. But when people have the right surgery and also are able to get a balance of their estrogen to progesterone ratio, those symptoms of histamine intolerance often improve. So those are things that all need to be considered and looked at, but there's no multidisciplinary approach around the care assessment diagnosis of this condition. Yes.
Even in the likes of the UK, so I was seen at a specialist centre for endometriosis, but again, it's the gynaecology team. So while they were amazing and my surgeon was competent with bowel surgery as well, if necessary, I was told that I might wake up with a colostomy bag depending on how the surgery went. Thankfully, I didn't, but there are women who were on my ward who lived my worst nightmare kind of thing. And I know women that have lost kidneys through it. So there are worst case scenarios out there, some a lot more morbid than that. It's still, even when you go and see specialists in the UK, it's still very much classed and lumped into the gynecology team.
Yeah, even like the specialist surgeons, they're
predominantly gynecologists.
Yeah, they are. And then they've specialised. And obviously you have to do additional training. And you basically, all you do is operate on women with endometriosis. And fantastic. But still, it's limited what you get outside of the surgery. You have to do all that research and find out all that information yourself. And women educate themselves through Facebook pages like the Nancy's Nook page, which is where a lot of people go. Obviously, we've got our page. And there's lots of other like Facebook pages that are similar to ours throughout the world. And that's how women are accessing their education and then getting, hopefully, the care that they need. But it's still not good enough. I mean, like, in Parliament in March 2025, there was a document presented, Endometriosis and the Knowledge Care Gap. And it was about how education failures have created a systemic pressure and barriers to diagnosis and care. So, like, some statistics from that, 85% of scans, so that's like an ultrasound scan or a transvaginal ultrasound scan, if people know what that is, missed the disease. And then 65% of all surgeries missed the disease. So that's what we're dealing with. Now, this is a UK study that was done. The outcome of it is that, unfortunately, the same themes are there: misdiagnosis, delays in treatment, inadequate medical support.
Not being believed,
yeah.
That's the hardest bit for people to deal with, is not being believed. And some of the worst have been other women.
Not listening to you.
In the medical profession and in work situations, other women can be the worst. Mm. It's just a painful period. Get over it. Walk it off.
The one thing I think we need to highlight is, especially for young girls out there and their mums that might be listening, is it's not normal to have period pain. Period pain is not normal. It's been normalised, like pain has for women throughout, hasn't it? I mean, endometriosis is a casualty of women's health. Women's health has been neglected forever. And endometriosis is one of those conditions which really highlights the problems that are in healthcare, because we don't focus on women's health. Research in health has always been done on men. And I'm not being biased against men in any way, but we really need to move forward with women's health in general. And endometriosis highlights that.
I was given a statistic about why this was. So what they said is, when they were looking at past research that was done, and this was more to do with the heart attack medication. That's why women are more likely to die from a secondary heart attack, is because the medication that you're given has only ever been tested on men. So one of the things that was explained to me was the reason that this happens is when they started researching, they never researched on women. And I suppose in a sense, it sounds like it come from the right place, but they never wanted to test on women who could potentially be pregnant. It could run the risk of them not being able to get pregnant. So there was, between the ages of sort of 16 through to 50, there was no testing done on women. So then you miss that broad scope of women that can have all sorts of conditions, and nothing's been tested on them. And I feel like it was the decision all those years ago was probably made from not a misogynistic place, but from what they thought was actually caring for women. But obviously what it's actually done, it's had a negative impact in women's health. One of the things I did was on a TED talk. I can't remember exactly who it was, but what she said was on one of the TED talks about endometriosis is they know more about how to make Viagra tasty and chewy than they do about the women's brain.
Because there's some recent research that's come out with regards to hysterectomies and the impact it can have on cognition. And it's not with removal of the ovaries, it's with the removal of the uterus. It's meant to potentially have a link in later life for cognitive difficulties. So that's something that's only just popped up. And now if you think about the treatment that they've been using for many, many years for this condition, the first point would have been hysterectomy, and they were given hysterectomies to girls in their 20s.
I know two women in their were in their 20s when they had a hysterectomy on the Isle of Man. One of them doesn't have an official diagnosis of endometriosis, but one does. And in their 20s, they had a radical hysterectomy. So that's the removal of the ovaries as well. When I went for my surgery back last year, the year before now, isn't it? December. Mm. I actually did have a hysterectomy, but I also have
adenomyosis.
Adenomyosis, which is it's called endometriosis evil twin, isn't it? So that's basically endometriosis, but it's on your internal part of your uterus. Obviously, endometriosis would be on the external part of your uterus. So I did have all the symptoms. Again, it's very much using a sledgehammer to crack a nut. The only way to completely diagnose adenomyosis 100% is to remove your uterus, cut it in half and look at it. That is the only way that they can diagnose this. But there are signs and symptoms that can show possible traits of adenomyosis, which is like the thickening of the womb and how big it is on MRI scans and stuff like that. So I did have a hysterectomy because I have adenomyosis. Now, over here, I was told to get rid of everything. So I went home, we discussed it with my partner, and I was like, right, we'll get rid of everything. The day of my surgery, I had two surgeons, one surgeon coming to speak to me, and she was like, I'm here to ask you not to get rid of your ovaries. And I was like, right, okay. I was like, I've spent 2 months getting used to the fact that you're taking everything away and all the things that come with having a radical hysterectomy. And she was like, I was 40, coming up to 43. And she was like, because you are right on the cusp of the cutoff, how detrimental it is of a 43-year-old and under to have her ovaries removed for your brain health. So she listed all the increased risks in certain diseases. So like Parkinson's was an increased risk of 12%, I think, which is higher than hereditary. So when I spoke to my other half, he was like, no, 12% Parkinson's, no, not doing it. Keep your ovaries. So I spoke to a couple of people who had also had similar surgery to me, and I asked them what they did, and they said that they again had their uterus removed but kept their ovaries because they're a similar age to me. So you look at this sort of detrimental effects of having a hysterectomy in your 40s to compared to what it is when you're in your 20s. I mean, the long-term effects of that later on in life just doesn't bear thinking about.
We don't know enough about the long-term effects. I mean, so when you're talking about keeping your ovaries, one of the reasons will be is because progesterone is a neuroprotective hormone. And when you have endometriosis, the thing that you don't have enough of is progesterone. We do have it, obviously, but we don't... The reason
it's not in balance.
It's not in balance. And the reason we have the growths and the lesions and all of those things is because estrogen is wonderful because it makes things grow. But when it's there without the progesterone, it makes things grow out of control. So that's why you need the progesterone in balance with the estrogen. And lots of women are advised, if they haven't had surgery, they're waiting for surgery and they've got lots of symptoms, to go into a chemical menopause. So they use medication called Prostrap. There's another one that was talked about last year in the media called Ryquil, which is Prostrap, but basically
with the HRT,
but with a tablet, not an injection, which Prostrap is an injection. Now, there are contraindications to use, and it has to be a personal choice. And you have, but when you have, so that medication actually was first for
cancer,
for prostate cancer, but they stopped using it for prostate cancer. There's contraindications to the use of the medication long term. So if you do take it, you're only meant to take it for 6 months, and then again another 6 months. This is the Prostrap, but women are being left on it for years and years and years and years. So the contraindications are loss of bone density.
Congenital heart defects, yeah. Not congenital heart defects. Yeah.
Cognitive impairment later in life. There are many different contraindications. And I know all medications come with a list, but it's the amount of women that come forward and say, actually, you know, I've been on this medication and I'm only like, I don't know, 35, and now I've got problems with my bone density. Well, you're not getting that back, are you? So it's not about, let's say, don't take that, because obviously what they say, when someone presents with the symptoms of a hormone imbalance, which could be endometriosis, you're given synthetic hormones. Fine, but not everybody wants that. Let's find out why it's happening and let's support that person's body to be able to maybe potentially not need that, because I'm not a doctor, right? But personally, I would not be taking synthetic hormones. I do take a micronized hormone, which is what you call body identical, because the contraindications of use are a lot less. And that's my informed decision after lots of research. And this is just a personal example. I've had the surgery, but I needed more than the surgery, and all women need more than the surgery, because you need to look at your nutrition, you need to look at basic your lifestyle in general and how you manage that to reduce inflammation. Because although you've removed the disease, there was something that was driving that disease that made that grow. So our bodies are very, very complex, and we all have to seek out that right advice and support with regard to the nutrition, nutritional support that we require, and also the hormonal support that we require. But there is one glaringly obvious thing that stands out, is that we all need progesterone. And the progesterone that's worked, and I'm on another Facebook group run by a functional health nutritionist called Kitty Martone, if anybody wants to look her up. She does have a page called Healthy Gut Girl, and she had lots of hormonal issues, fibroids, etc. And she also runs a page called Estrogen Dominance Support Group. And it's really worth going on there and reading those files and learning about how progesterone works and how it protects your body. There's another doctor, she's a pharmacist, Carol Peterson, and she's a compounding pharmacist, and she has a wealth of knowledge about progesterone. So if you've got this condition or you know somebody that has it, I'm not giving you medical advice, but what I'm saying is you need to advocate for yourself and you need to look after your own health. Even if you have the right surgery, nobody else is going to look after your health there on in unless you do. Find the information, read it, educate yourself and decide what you want to do. But what I can say is, since I've been taking bioidentical progesterone and I have had to learn how to dose it for my body, because you only hold on to progesterone for 12 hours max, and we all metabolize it differently, I probably need to be supplementing it in smaller doses 3 times a day. But what you have to be very careful is when you take progesterone, bioidentical progesterone, what you start doing is you start releasing the stored estrogen that's within your body. Because we store estrogen within cells in our body, but we don't store progesterone. And that's why endometriosis grows. So for me, I always used to get cyclical breast pain, progesterone. Now I know how to dose it for myself, I don't get it. So what I'm saying is educate yourself, find out how you can do that, and use nutrition as well. Especially, I wish I'd had bioidentical progesterone when I was 15, 16. But especially if you're going into perimenopause, or you've got this type of condition, or you think you have, and you want to get pregnant and you're struggling, you need to really look into this and how it can support your body. Because the mainstream medical profession is probably behind where it needs to be, that you're going to be able to access. You can't go to a 15-minute, 5-minute, 10-minute GP appointment and expect them to get that information. Hopefully we can get to the point where you can go to a GP and they've got pathways in place and they know how to refer you so you can get the right treatment and surgery. But outside of that, we need to look at how we're going to support that from a long-term perspective and support people prior to that.
I'm going to come back to something you said earlier, Sharon. You mentioned in our earlier conversation it took 9 years to diagnose.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that? Why does it take so long to diagnose it?
A lot of it, what I can make out, obviously for myself, I was only a year. I was very lucky, so I can't really live that experience.
That's the exception.
I'm an exception. I am an exception to the rule. But what I do see with a lot of people who come through on the group and what I've read about is people don't listen. My GP was fantastic. When I was presenting again with it, I went in to see my GP and she was unbelievable. She was amazing. She did explain to me, I'm obviously not an endometriosis specialist. You think it's your endometriosis specialist. And she said, it's probably not massively helpful, but how can I help you? What do you need me to do? What do you want? So I said I wanted to go back to Mr. Ghosh, and a letter was typed and it was gone by the end of the day. Again, that would have been sort of 9 years ago. So I'd not long had my little boy who's 10. So she was fantastic. But my story, again, is very different. Mm-hmm. I had the same GP who referred me to Ramsey all those years ago. She is amazing. And she was really helpful. But when you speak to other GPs, and it's not always men, it's not always women, but they just go, periods are painful.
Mm. This is why you're looking to create a specialist
centre, isn't
it? We need
to create a pathway.
So there are specialist centres that we can access. We're never going to have a specialist centre in the Isle of Man. You just couldn't have that level of surgeons here. Yes, there's a lot of women who are impacted by this condition and women who don't know that they've got it.
Do you roughly know how many have approached you about it?
How many are on the page?
Over 300 now.
Yeah, mm. I would have thought going up to 400.
Yeah, so.
And that's only people who are on social media.
Yeah.
So, like, I know people who aren't on social media who obviously are impacted by this condition as well.
There's a couple of women that I know who are on social media but don't actually want to be part of the group because they're very private and that's
so essentially it's many more than those 300 or 400 that are on the group.
I mean, the thing is, we can be referred to St Mary's in Manchester and then Liverpool Women's. Those are the ones in the northwest. There are centres throughout the United Kingdom, and obviously you've got private practitioners as well if you're going to have to go down that route. But getting that referral to that specialist centre is very, very difficult, because if you think how difficult it is to get from your GP to gynaecology, to get from gynaecology to the specialist centre, because I think if you're seen to be in treatment with a gynaecologist here,
in the UK?
Then that has to be done, like Sharon was saying about herself before that they could refer on to that specialist centre. But what needs to happen is, so diagnosis currently is a diagnostic laparoscopy. So that doesn't mean that they're going to remove any of the disease necessarily. They might burn some of it off, which is the ablation, which is not the gold standard. They might take pockets of it to do in pathology so they could tell whether it's endometriosis lesions or not. But they're not doing that specialist surgery when you just do a diagnostic laparoscopy in a general hospital, you know. So like the Isle of Man would be considered like a cottage hospital, really, when it comes to gynecology type services. We're not specialists.
You couldn't ask them to train, because obviously we do have 300 women, 400 women on the group. That's not enough to train one person to become the specialist. They're doing seven surgeries every single day.
It's not realistic.
I was operated on a Sunday. So there is surgeries going on. I was in a room with three other women, and I know that my surgeon also operated on two other women from the room behind. The problem that we have at the moment as well is obviously fitting in to the UK, because we don't have the same agreements that we used to have all those years ago. And I've just quickly looked it up, but I don't have the accurate ones. So I think this has been brought down. The UK did a big drive on this in 2024. Because of COVID, there was over 750,000 women on the gynaecology list in the NHS in the UK.
But that wasn't a specialist, that was just gynaecology.
That was just gynaecology, 750,000 women. So obviously then you've got to get the Isle of Man patients in there as well. I nearly waited 2 years.
Well, thinking about the Isle of Man, because like you said, it does complicate things considerably when you're on a tiny island. What would your ideal be for women in the future? If you could kind of, write blank sheet of paper, if you could make it better for women, how would you do that?
To access the specialist service from the start. So you could have a screening service here, because really when it goes to diagnosis worldwide, they want to move away from diagnostic laparoscopy, because that's just, it's not viable. And you're giving a person a surgery for the sake of a surgery, potentially in some cases, and not the right surgery. So do we want to do that? We're wasting resources if we're thinking about it from resources that healthcare have. So if we have the right pathways in place, the right education, so it's about updating the medical curriculum for undergraduates, but also obviously those already working, about what this condition is so they recognise it, but then working with the people affected, with people obviously work in those areas, the specialists in this area, and looking at the care pathways. Okay, so you come to the GP, this is in an ideal world, they have a tick sheet of symptoms. Okay, but now we know that if we do this, this and this, actually we're just putting more pressure on our healthcare system and not giving them the diagnosis and actually maybe doing unnecessary medical procedures. Let's have the agreement where they go to the specialist centre and then they have the investigations and the surgery there. You're cutting down waiting times, you're cutting down medical expenses here that often you see women having here that don't give you any idea that they've got the condition, and it's actually just putting them through more investigations that are stressful. So it would be basically updating medical curriculum for practitioner training, upskilling the practitioners so that they can recognize and identify patient education and advocacy so that they know what to advocate for. And then within that, if we've got all of that, then we can have that pathway, can't we? Because they can feed into it. It sounds simple for me to say, and I know it's not, but what happens is people have meetings after meetings after meetings and nothing ever happens. We know what we need to do. Let's do it, because actually you're going to save money, and you're going to save money not just for health services, but think of how it impacts on young girls out of education. So then they're not getting the education that they're entitled to because they're off school because of it. Then you've got employment, and people aren't able to be in employment. So then they're relying on maybe benefits, because it does affect some people in that way.
Yeah, they are that severe. It's scary how it can affect in such a variety of ways. And like you said before, it's not just endometriosis that you can have. You can also have other autoimmune. So I've got celiac disease and I also have Raynaud's, but there are other autoimmune diseases that actually come hand in hand with endometriosis that have a lot more severe impact than, have to follow a gluten-free diet, or my hand's getting cold and, my finger's feeling a bit stiff. So there are people who are genuinely off work. I mean, one of our members reached out to me a couple of years ago saying that her boss is putting pressure on her, and she might have actually lost her job in the end. So then they're on benefits. So that's obviously then impacting
the economy
that way. So there's if you take emotion out of it, we are throwing money away. If you take away the emotional side and it's personal, people's lives here, you are actually just throwing money away. My surgery was a complete waste of time over here. I'm not belittling my surgeon. I think he's fantastic. He's a great surgeon. But as he explained to me, he was a general gynecology surgeon. So there are surgeries that he can do that are beneficial, but mine was to treat endometriosis. We kind of knew that when we were going in. So truthfully, I should have been seen in the UK. And then that's a surgery that then opened for somebody that might have something different that can actually treat over here. Mm. So then you're decreasing the waiting list and using the slots and the spaces for people who have surgery that's not endometriosis, that's not the sort of specialist need, because there are plenty others. Like, endometriosis is just one of many gynecology conditions that obviously need medical intervention. So you sort of, ideally at the moment, I think the best thing that could happen today would be any GP that is seeing a woman, child, girl with painful periods, with excessive bleeding, with spotting throughout the month, with fatigue, is to listen to them.
Mm.
That is, today, that is something that you can change without the ideal world situation. Well, just listen to them.
If we get it right for women, we get it right for everybody. I think I said that last year, because it's women who, this is not me being anti-men at all, but it's women who hold it all together. We're responsible for the most of the childcare and the child rearing. You know, we go out to work and we do all of those things, but also other caring roles like elderly parents or elderly relatives. If we get it right for women, then we get it right for everybody, and you improve quality of life for everybody, not just the people that are affected. Because if you've got a mum who can't be a mum, what impact does that have on her children? You know, you've got a teenage girl who can't be a teenage girl, then she can't have all those experiences that a teenage girl should be having. You know, let's get it right so that we can improve quality of life, and the knock-on impact will be from an economic perspective. And I think that's what would drive medical side to get on board, because they're always wanting to save money. But let's stop talking about it. Let's stop having meetings after meetings after meetings. Let's just do something about it and move forward, not just on the Isle of Man. It's worldwide.
Well, in the meantime, you do have this fabulous group that you've created, and you're there for women or anyone who wants to know, you know, sort of about the condition. So if someone wants to approach you and wants to become a member of the group, what will they get out of that?
Like, we post educational information there, and if you want to read it, you can read it. If you don't want to, you don't want to, because we can answer your questions and we can tell you how to get the right referrals, and we can, like, say, this is our experience with this, and we can point you in the right direction for information. But you have to read that, you have to make that decision yourself, and have the confidence to advocate and move forward.
But we give you the information to advocate for yourself. That's stuff that you might not necessarily know. Mm. Before I had my Facebook account shut down, I was documenting what I was doing, like diet-wise, exercise-wise, things that I did that I found benefited me. And then I would post things that I'd tried, that I'd read on blogs and stuff like that, that actually didn't help me. But just because it didn't help me doesn't mean that it won't help someone else. Mm-hmm. Stuff that I ate, stuff why I ate it, books that I was reading. I spoke to Endometriosis UK, and while I don't want to take Carrie, who was another one of our members who was very active with us, she was doing a lot of work with Endometriosis UK, but I reached out to a contact that I have with Endometriosis UK, and while we're not bringing them over here actively at the moment, they have a hotline that's out there, which you can just Google Endometriosis UK nurse-led hotline, and it will take you to the number. As Isle of Man, because we do donate to them, we have access to this hotline, and that's what I shared, and that's what got me shut down, I think. So that is out there. What they will say is that obviously some of the pathways are different in the UK to what they are here, mm-hmm. but the actual medical information and what they can do to help you will still be the same. So that is there, and that's available to not just our members, but to anyone on the island who's suffering with endometriosis. There is a nurse-led hotline out there in the UK run by Endometriosis UK, and it's really good.
Yeah, and I also think, like, if anybody wants to reach out to us, it's not... If you're an employer and you employ women, you need to know about this and you need to look at how you would support them. If you're in educational facility, so that could be a school, college, the university, any of those places, you need to be aware of this condition. And if somebody has it and they disclose it to you, how you support them, because they want to be there and they want to do the best they can, but they need support.
Well, it's been fascinating, Chad. Your knowledge on this is extraordinary. I mean, the two of you are specialists in your own right, I think. So just remind anyone that's listening then how they do access this group and hopefully get to speak to you wonderful people who will give them support and help.
So it's the Manx Endometriosis Support Group and it's on Facebook. That's where we are predominantly. We did say that obviously you can contact Manx Radio if you want to be put in touch with us personally and we can reach out to you directly. Facebook is definitely the best way. So we are out there.
Well, we are. And the reason we can't really monitor our email regularly is because we both work, we've got families, and this is just a sideline. So, you know, if we don't get back to you, if we do and then we don't, just
don't
get,
take it personal.
No, just come back to us again.
You're doing your best at the
end of the day. Yeah, because honestly, we're happy if, like, you want to just come into your workplace and talk, do a talk about endometriosis. We did one for Manx Care in July, to health professionals, and screened a documentary about endometriosis. We hope to do more of those, and we hope to work with Manx Care more. So, you know, if you're a private provider of any kind, like I said, an educational institution, we are more than happy to come in, but our time is limited, so it has to be worked in around that.
Absolutely. Thank you for being so honest and open and sharing what is a fascinating but frustrating story, I think. Fingers crossed it all gets easier in the future, but with advocates like yourself and the awareness you're putting out there, I'm sure it will. So thank you for taking the time and all the very best to you and your families too.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks.